All right, we're beginning here on the top of Mem Hey Amud Aleph by the two dots. Gemara says, "How avdo da'arak mechutz la'aretz la'aretz." This eved ran away from his master, but ran away from chutz la'aretz to Eretz Yisrael. Azal marei abatrei. His master chased him down, wanted to get him back, so chased him down to Eretz Yisrael. Ata lekamei derabi ami, and then they brought the case before Rabbi Ami to adjudicate. Amalei. Nichtov lecha shtara ad-demei. We'll have the Eved write you an IOU on his value. Uchtov le gita decheruta. And you're going to write the get shechrur to this Eved. Vilo. And if you do not abide by this, mefakna le minach. I'm going to take him away from you. Midrabi Achai b'Rabbi Ushaya. Because of the member of Rabbi Achai b'Rabbi Ushaya, which we're going to see in 1 second, I'm going to take this Eved away from you. I'm basically going to confiscate your property if you don't adhere to the psak halacha here to free him, and he will write you an IOU over his monetary value. He's ole la'aretz, and one of the things that grants an eved freedom if the ba'alim do not want to follow him is making aliyah la'aretz. Now, over here, there are a number of questions. First of all, did Rabbi Ami really have the right to confiscate the eved or to tell him that if you don't abide by this, we're going to confiscate the eved? Because here the Baal or the Adon has options, one of which is to make aliyah with his eved. Let's assume that that wasn't a plausible solution because the fact that he's chasing him down, trying to bring him back, seems like that wasn't an option. But what he could do is sell him to a Jew within Eretz Yisrael. His only obligation is to allow the eved to live in Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't have an obligation to free the eved or to give up his monetary ownership inside of this eved. So he could have sold him within Eretz Yisrael. Many of the Rishonim believe that Eino Chanami, had he been willing to either live in Eretz Yisrael or sell the eved in Eretz Yisrael, we would have allowed him to do that. But for whatever reason, that wasn't the case, and he did not want to make aliyah, and either he couldn't find buyers for the eved in Eretz Yisrael, or he didn't want to sell the eved in Eretz Yisrael, and that's why Rabbi Ami compels him to deal with the eved in this manner. The other thing is, the fact that he has to write an IOU for his money also shows you that in Mi'ikar Adin, the eved is not just entitled to freedom, it's just that this is a takana for the eved. It's to his benefit to write an IOU on himself and to pay the adon, because the alternatives are not as good for him. So for instance, if his master sells him to another party inside of Eretz Yisrael, he would have succeeded at living in Eretz Yisrael, but he would have been still a slave to someone else. So Rabbi Ami, in setting it up in this manner, allows him to pay for himself, gain his freedom, and remain in Eretz Yisrael. So that's why he had him pay for himself. Or others suggest that he pays for himself because that's part of the Tikkun Olam. Because if he doesn't pay for himself, what the owners of slaves and chutzlars are going to do is start to chain them down and make sure that they don't run away because of the possibility, if they run to Eretz Yisrael, that they're going to lose them entirely, and not only in terms of the slave being lost, but the monetary ownership is going to be lost, and therefore they're going to take extra precautions, which is going to cause problems for other slaves. So in order not to precipitate that type of problem, we say pay for yourself, so that it doesn't cause a larger problem. So for any of those and all of those reasons, the situation here is that Rabbi Ami coerces him to give a get shechur for the eved to give an IOU, and he invokes this principle based on Rabbi Achai and Rabbi Ushaya, which the question is whether that is the halacha or not. Some of the Rishonim believe that he did this halachically correctly, and Rabbi Achai and Rabbi Ushaya is the halacha, and that's what he used to pressure him. Others say that it's not the halacha, but he still used that position to pressure the Adon to do what he wanted. That's a bigger question about pressuring litigants, whether you can use opinions that are not the halacha. According to the Ramban and many others, you can only use halachic positions to coerce or pressure a litigant to do what you want. Other Rishonim believe that you can even use illegitimate positions, positions that we don't pass in halacha, in order to force the party to do what you want. So over here, that would be part of that question as to whether Rabbi Chai and Rabbi Ushaya has accepted halacha. D'tanya, lo yishvu ba'artzecha pen yachatiu otcha li. So we don't want them to stay in your land because maybe they will cause you to sin, which is that we want you to eliminate the inhabitants of the land, because those that are left behind are going to cause you to sin or cause problems for you. You would think that even in a case where he's accepted not to worship Avodah Zarah, that would also be true, and he would not be able to be in the land. Tamalomar lo tasgir eved el adunav, ashein azel alecha mi'im adunav. That you may not return an eved to his master if he came to seek sanctuary with you from his master. My takanato, then what is the way to fix this? Imcha yeshev bikirbecha. That he will see, he will live with, together with you, mean that he will be given a right to stay with you, a residency here in Eretz Yisrael. So the way that the Braita is interpreting the psukim, it is saying that there's an overarching requirement to eliminate all those people that will cause you to sin. Then it seems that there's a dispensation for individuals who do not worship a Buddha Zerah, or basically are a gir toshav, and therefore they will not be a negative influence on you. They learned that out from the pasuk of Lo Tazkir Eved El Adunav. Asher Yinatzel Alecha Mi'im Adunav. So now, Asher Yinatzel Alecha, it is not here the term being used as seeking sanctuary from you, but rather, Asher Yinatzel Alecha, which is someone who joins you, someone who acquiesces to live the lifestyle that you live in the Haaretz, that individual you will not return to is Adunav. And therefore, Imcha Yeshev Bikirbecha, that's why he's allowed to live together with you. V'kasha le'er Rabbi Shaya. Rabbi Shaya doesn't like that interpretation of the Braita, because hi mi'im adunav, it's not mi'im adunav that he comes to you, rather mi'im aviv, or mi'im elohav mi'bayile, that he's coming to you, asher yinatzel elecha, he comes to join your ranks from, not from his master, it's from either his father, the ways of his father, or from elohav, from his God. He's giving up his former ways of avodah zarah, and joining your way of life. And so therefore the mi'im in that pasuk does not seem to be consistent with the interpretation that you are giving. El amar Rav Hoshaya, b'mocher avdol l'chutz ha'aretz ha'katuv medaber. That pasuk of lo tasgir eved adunav is really referring to an eved kenani that's being sold to chutz la'aretz. And then you would have to explain ashe yinatzel to mean miyached o mafrish, that he designates or separates, which is that he's sending him out from the klal, who's in Eretz Yisrael, to Chutz Laretz. V'kashale Rav Achai b'Rav Hoshaya, hai asher yinatzel alecha, asher yinatzel mimcha mibayile. The way the pasuk is written is not proper now, because it's not asher yinatzel alecha that runs to you. It says asher yinatzel mimcha. It should be someone who's being forced away from you. Because over here he's selling the eved from Eretz Yisrael to Chutz Laretz, which means that he's being pushed out, not being taken in. Ella, Amar Rabbi Chai b'Rabbi Shaya, that can't be the explanation, but rather, Ve'eved b'shar barach michutz la'aretz la'aretz ha'katuv medaber. Here is the interpretation of the pasuk, which is that it's talking about an eved that ran away from chutz la'aretz to Eretz Yisrael. So this is the third explanation of this pasuk. We have the first explanation, which is the Tanakhama, says it's referring to people who join you in Eretz Yisrael and abide by the laws of the land, keep the Shiva Mitzvah B'nai Noach, you're allowed to give them sanctuary, allow them to live in the land. Rabbi Hoshaya comes along and says, no, this is talking about a case of an Eved that is being sold from Eretz Yisrael to Chutz La'aretz. And again, Rabbi Chai Rabbi Hoshaya says, even that has a failing in it, in the interpretation, because it shouldn't say, Asher Yinatzel Elecha, but rather Asher Yinatzel Mimcha, that's going away from you, not coming to you. So therefore, he gives the third possibility, which is the interpretation here is an Eved that's running from Chutz La'aretz to Eretz Yisrael. Because that's Asher Yinatzel Elecha. He's coming for sanctuary. He's coming to you. Over there it says, Lo Tasgir Eved Adonav. You cannot return him to his master. Meaning that he is given the right of freedom when he comes to Eretz Yisrael. Now again, how literally or how halachic is that position? Rabbi Ami invoked it to threaten this individual and say, Rabbi Chai b'Rav Hoshaya says that an Eved that runs to Eretz Yisrael is given his freedom. So whether that literally means he's given his freedom without any payments, without anything else, and therefore using that threat, he coerces the master to give him his freedom and the slave to say, I owe you, because otherwise I'm just going to take him and he's going to be free, period. Whether he could have really invoked this, Rabbi Chai b'Rav Hoshaya, and Rabbi Chai b'Rav Hoshaya really believes that the Eved goes free without any compensation, it's not clear here, and that's what we discussed before, the different approaches of the Rishonim of how to reconcile between Rabbi Ami's position and Rabbi Chai b'Rav Hoshaya. Tanya Idach, we have an alternate braita. Lo tazgir eved adunav. Rabbi Omer belokech eved amanat l'shachar roa katu medaber. Rabbi gives us now a fourth interpretation of the pasuk, which is this is someone who purchases an eved on the condition to free him. Hey chidami, what exactly is the case here? Amar Rav Nachum Yitzach, dichtev lei. Hachi. He wrote this, he incorporated this in the contract. That when I purchase you, then you will own yourself from now. Meaning that retroactively from now, you will own yourself once I have acquired the rights to you. Vchista had an eved that ran away to Beit Kutai. As Rashi points out, Beit Kutai is not in Eretz Yisrael. That is a place in Chutz Laretz. And in addition to that, it seemingly is a place of the Kutim, which are individuals who did not necessarily subscribe to the positions of the Chachamim. They might have abided by Torah Shebichtav, but not so much Torah Shebe'alpeh. So this eved ran away to this city, to this area. Shalach lohu hadrua ani'ali. He sends over to them, return my slave to me. I mean, he's my rightful property. Please return him to me. Shalchulei lo tazgir eved el adunav. The pasuk says, you can't return a runaway slave to its master. So they quote him a pasuk from the Torah. Shalach lohu, he sends back to them. I'm reading the parentheses now, because if you look in the Rashi, it's clear that Rashi had the gears of the parentheses there. Shalchulei lohu chen tased l'chamaro. He sends to them that there's an obligation to return an aveda. Now, aveda does not just mean a lost object, but it means anything. It means a chamor, a simla, uluchol avidat achicha. And the eved is one of those items that would be incorporated under this requirement to do hashavat aveda. Shachulei, v'aktiv lo tizkir v'al dunav. Now again, which way it was that they sent him the pasuk of Lotus Girvan of Dinav, whether they opened with that, or over here, they said it after he said, please return the Aveda. It's not clear. Obviously, they didn't say it twice. Then, Shalach Lohu. Now, he responds to that claim. Shalach Lohu, Ha'u be'eved shebarach mechutz la'aretz la'aretz. He says, no. The explanation of that pasuk is a case where an eved runs from chutz la'aretz to Yisrael, Rabbi Achai b'Rabbi Oshaya. And it gives the interpretation of Rabbi Achai b'Rabbi Oshaya. Why did he send them the interpretation of Rabbi Achai and Rabbi Oshaya? Why didn't he send them the interpretation of Rabbi? In the end, we had two readings of this pasuk. One reading is the reading of Rabbi, who says that it's talking about someone who bought a slave to free him. And one interpretation is that of Rabbi Achai and Rabbi Oshaya, which is talking about a slave that ran from Chutz Laaretz to Eretz Yisrael. So why did he opt to give them the explanation of Rabbi Chai by Rabbi Oshaya and not that of Rabbi? Shum damash malahu krai. Says very simply, they read psukim and they are willing to accept a pshat in the pasuk, which is reasonable, or in other words, could be read as the pshat, as the simple meaning of the pasuk. Rabbi's interpretation is clearly not the simplest reading of the pasuk, and you would, just by reading the pasuk, never come to that conclusion that you're talking about someone who promised the slave that he was going to free him. That's written nowhere in the pasuk. At least over here, when you're talking about the interpretation of Rabbi Chai b'Rabbi Oshaya, you're talking about an eved who is running away. So that makes sense, because that is what the pasuk is speaking about, an eved that runs away. It's just qualified by the limitation that it's talking about an eved that runs from Chutz Laaretz to Eretz Yisrael. But at least that, they could possibly accept as an interpretation of the pasuk, and that's why he sent it to them. We don't have any conclusion to the story as to whether they bought into his claim and sent the eved back, or whether they thought that that was not the interpretation of the pasuk, but rather a broader interpretation, which is anytime an eved runs away, you don't have to return him. Abaye irkes lei chamra Beit Kutai. So now another story that involves this area or this location of Beit Kutai. Abaye had a chamor, a donkey that ran away to Beit Kutai. Shalach lohu shadru ali. So he sent over to them a message, please return the chamor. So here, as opposed to the eved, where you might have questions as to whether he is subsumed under the halacha of hashavat aveda, because there you require that it be metaltalin and have inherent value, and eved, it's questionable there. Here by chamor, it's even written explicitly in the pasuk, you have to return it. Shalchulei shalach simana. They said to them, no problem, just send a siman that it is your chamor. We have no problem returning it. We just want to return it to the rightful owner. How do we know that you're the rightful owner? Shalach lo dechivara kreisei. So he sent back to them that it has a white underbelly. Shalchulei ilav de nachmaniat. If it wasn't for the fact that you're nachmani, lo ave mishadran alei nialach, we would not return the chamor to you. Atay kulei chamrei lav kreisayu chivarin ninu. Don't all donkeys have a white underbelly? Yeah, this is not a siman muvhak. It's not a determinant siman or identifying character of this chamor. Every chamor looks like that. So in the end, they said, the only reason we'll return to you is because you are known or you have a reputation as being a Talmud Chacham, a leader of the community and being honest, and therefore we'll return it to you. But otherwise, we wouldn't return it to you. From here, you learn that a Talmud Chacham can make a claim for an Aveda b'tviyat ayin, simply by saying it is mine or just looking at it and saying that it is mine. And that if a Chacham says that we don't question the veracity of his statement in that case because of the nemanut that he carries. And so that here you see that with the Abaye, and the way that they acted with the Abaye is that they granted him the right to take it back, even though he didn't have a proper siman in the chamor. You would generally ask for a siman in a case like that, even if it was a Talmud Chacham. If you can't produce it, the question is, do you still believe him anyway? So now, over here, he's called Nachmani. Rashi, earlier in the Masechta, says that he was called Nachmani because he was brought up by Rabba Bar Nachmani. Rabba Bar Nachmani is Stam Rabba in Shas, and we know that Abaye and Rava were orphaned when they were young, and Rabba takes them in as orphans into his house. So he was, in essence, Rabba was his foster father. So he named him after his father, Rabba Bar Nachmani. So then he called Abaye Nachmani because it was his father's name, and he gave him that name, his adopted name in a sense, out of respect for his father, the same way that he would have named his child after his father's name. So he names Abaye after his father, and that's how he got the name. That's what Rashi says earlier on in the Masechta, as to whether that was the name that Rabba gave to him, or that's the way that people called him, because he came from the household of Rabba Bar Nachmani, and therefore they called him Nachmani. Rashi seems to say he actually named him that. Over there, the Rabbi Akiva Eiger brings down from the Aruch an alternate explanation of Nachmani, and he says that Abaye's real name was Nachmani. The problem was for Rabba that if Abaye's name was Nachmani, then he couldn't call him by his name because then he'd be calling his father's name. So he didn't want to call him Nachmani because then it would be sound like he was using his father's first name. So he gave him the alternative name of Abaye, which he says is a bastardization of the word Avi in Aramaic, which is Avi, my father, because he shared the same name as his father. So he called him Abaye, which in a sense is like the Aramaic for father, because he carried the same name as his father, and that's why he called him Abaye. So his real name was Nachmani, and he called him Abaye. That's the way the Aruch reads it. Rashi's the other way around, that his real name was Abaye, but he got the adopted name of Nachmani because of the fact that he lived in the house of Rabba Bar Nachmani. So anyway, that's why Abaye is known as Nachmani, and that's what they called him. You see over here, the people of Bei Kutai. Okay, next Mishnah, another Mishnah of Tikkun Olam. This Mishnah, unfortunately, has been relevant through the ages and still relevant till today. And in the last number of years has been very controversial in terms of both the Mishnah and the Gemara. Shezein podim et teshvuyim yeter al kidei demehem vipnei Tikkun Olam. One is not allowed to redeem captives, hostages, for a greater than their underlying value because of Tikkun Olam, which the Gemara will address in 1 second. What is the Tikkun Olam here? What are we worried about in terms of redeeming hostages or captives at levels greater than their value? We do not encourage the captives or hostages to run away. Again, because of Tikkun Olam, again, the Gemara will discuss what's exactly the Tikkun Olam. Rav Shmuel Meomer, Mipnei Takanat HaShvuim. It's not because of the Tikkun Olam, but rather because of Takanat HaShvuim, which, again, the Gemara will explain what the difference is between these two opinions as to encouraging these captives to run away, or what the problem will be if we have them run away. In terms of being Podel HaShvuim, it says, Yeter Kedei Demehem, more than their underlying value. What is the determination of their underlying value? The obvious one that the Gemara is using is that it's the slave market. You go to the slave market and you know how much you sell a person of this standing quality individual in the market, and then you have a price to use. That works when you have an active slave market or you have an active auction market where you can get a sense of the value of an individual. Once that disappears, what do you do in terms of evaluating the value of such an individual? So there are some Rishonim that say despite the fact that that went away, we still use that as the benchmark for what we would charge for someone. For instance, you go to countries where they still have an active slave trade, and you figure out what the cost of individuals is. But then the other possibility is that there's a market for ransoming captives, or for hostages. And that is that what other nations or what other non-Jews would pay to ransom their own relatives or their own captives or hostages, that will be the benchmark by which we determine how much we should pay for them. And that'd be kedei demehen. And obviously that could have ramifications both the kula and the chumra, because today in the Western world, people are willing to pay huge ransoms to get hostages or captives back, and therefore that would then open up the possibility of paying these large sums, because that's considered to be the market value of an individual. That's number one. Number two is the tikkun olam over here, which is that one is not allowed to do this because of tikkun olam. What is that? So the Gemara says, Yibailu, hai mipnei tikkun olam. What is the tikkun olam here? Is it mishum duchaka de tziburahu? Is the problem here that you are putting a large burden on the tzibur, meaning that the higher and higher the ransoms get, the more money that the community is going to have to raise in order to ransom these captives, and therefore we're worried about the plight of communities that have to ransom captives, that the amount of money is going to be exorbitant, and therefore we don't want that happening. So basically they put a cap and says we're not going to pay more because the burden placed on the community will be too great, and therefore there's a cap at what we will pay. O Dilma, Mishum delo legarvo velaitu tvei. Problem is that that will encourage the taking of more hostages or captives, because the more money you pay, the more lucrative the trade is, the more reason for to take these people as captives or as hostages, because the payback becomes bigger and bigger. And it only serves to encourage that type of behavior. If they think they're not going to get anything for it, then their value is diminished significantly. And the reasons to take the risk, to take these individuals as captives or hostages, is diminished. And so here, in order not to facilitate this type of behavior or continued behavior, we don't want to pay more money because that will just encourage the continued taking of captives, which happens now, whether it's in Northern Africa or in the Middle East. In terms of Western captives, they know that they're going to pay more and more and more. And the more money that they pay, the more that there is a reason to take these individuals as captives, and that's what's happening. It's creating a trade, or basically their economies are running on this, taking up hostages and captives and ransoming them, and that's how they raising capital for whatever they want to do or whatever areas that they rule over. That money is then used to further their own purposes. So that's what the Gemara says over here. Tashma, the Levi bar Darga, Pirka lebrate betleisar alfei dinarei zahav. Levi bar Darga, who seems to be obviously a wealthy individual, redeemed his daughter for 13,000 gold coins, which was an exorbitant sum, clearly in excess of her value. So from here, the Gemara wants to prove that obviously the reason is duchaka de tzibura, because here he paid privately. So therefore there was no burden on the community because he took the burden on himself. Now, in terms of encouraging this to happen again, this would serve to do that. And the fact that he did this and was allowed to do this shows you that the reason must be duchaka de tzibur. Amar Abaye, Uman Leimelan de Ritzon Chachamim Abad, who says he was abiding by the principles of the Chachamim, the Takanot Chachamim over here. It's true that he did it. Doesn't mean he was doing it under the auspices of the Chachamim. Dilma Shlo Ritzon Chachamim Abad, maybe he did this against the position of the Chachamim. Now, there are a number of Gemaras that we have to reconcile with the Gemara over here, and how the Rishonim reconcile those Gemaras has large implications for what the Halacha should be. First of all, just as background, in terms of Pidyon Shvuyim, it's one of the greatest mitzvot that can be done. And the Gemara, in terms of putting hierarchy on the mitzvah of Pidyon Shvuyim, it trumps many other mitzvot. The Gemara in Baba Batra on Daf Chet even says that one can sell a Sefer Torah in order to do Pidyon Shvuyim. So knowing that the Sefer Torah, in terms of a hierarchy of value, both monetarily as well as spiritually, we know that Sefer Torah sits at the top of that hierarchy. The fact that you can sell a Sefer Torah to ransom captives tells you the level of this mitzvah or the greatness of this mitzvah. And the Gemara as well as the Rishonim speak about the tremendous mitzvah that is done, and that it's a good thing people ransom captives because of the tremendous difficulty that captives are under when they're kept there or the hostages are kept there. So Pidyon Shvuyim is a mitzvah that is a tremendous mitzvah, and is something that the community should engage in and make sure to take care of those that are taken into captivity or those that are taken as hostages. That's number one. Number two is we have a Gemara further on, which we're going to bump into on Daf Nun Chet, which creates somewhat of a problem, because on Daf Nun Chet, there's a story about Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya, who goes to Rome, and while he's in Rome, he finds out about that there's a little kid that was taken into captivity over there. And he basically says, I'm not leaving here until I take him back with me. And the Gemara says over there that he does do that, but he pays an exorbitant sum to have this child released. And he turns out to be a great Talmud Chacham. This child that he releases, he's Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha. So the question is, how did Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya allow to do this? He's in violation of this takana to overpay for hostage or ransom a captive because he pays a tremendous amount of money for this young child. That's number one. The second thing is a Gemara in Ketubot, which says that a husband has to redeem his wife, that's part of the obligations of Ketubah, up to 10 times the value of his wife. At least the first time. Then the question of the second and third time is more controversial, but at least the first time. But again there's a requirement to redeem his wife for up to 10 times her value. Over there, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel comments and says, no, don't do that, mipnei tikkun olam. So now the question is, how do you resolve this Gemara, the Gemara Nun Chet, and the Gemara in Ketubot? The resolution of those three Gemarot will determine what you think the halacha is here with regards to ransom captives. Tosfot over here raises the issue and says, what about that case in Ketubot where he has to ransom his wife for more than 10 times his value? Shiny Ishto, Tavia Kugufo. Ishto Kugufo means that your wife is just like you. And Tosfot says over here, there is no restriction on how much money you spend to redeem yourself. That is, no matter whether you think that the reason here is Duchak de Tzibura, or whether you think it's encouraging hostage taking again, we cannot limit how much you spend on yourself, because that a person can make a decision for how much he wants to spend, how much money he wants to give up to keep his life. It's his life. He can make the determination as to what he wants to spend to spare his life. We can't impose on others to spend that money to spare his life, but in terms of himself, he can make that decision. So Tosfot has one exemption from the rule, is yourself. Included in an exemption is your wife. But that's it. Other relatives are not included in on that. The person themselves and their wife is excluded. That's how he explains the Gemara in Ketubot. What about the Gemara further on, Daf Nun Chet? Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, de Pirkei Da'utinok b'mamon arbei, b'fi sheya muflag b'chochma. Here comes Tosfot. One of his big exceptions is for a Talmud Chocham. Someone who's unusually steeped in Talmud Torah, a leader of the generation, someone who's going to be a Morei Hora'a, or is already a Morei Hora'a. There is an exception for that, and that's why he did it, even though it was against the Takana. Inami, b'shat churban habayit, lo shayech lo ligarbo. Or, if he was taken in hostage in Rome, this was around the time of the churban habayit. At that time, there was no need to encourage the taking of captives. It was a free-for-all. They were taking captives, and so his paying the money was not going to encourage more taking of captives. That was already happening, or that was already in place. Tosafot, later on Daf Nun Chet, gives a third answer to this, and he says, Ki ika sakanat nefashot podin shvuim yoter al kedei demehem. When there's risk of life, then we don't abide by this takanat chachamim, and we redeem captives because their lives are at risk. So now, Tosafot already here gave 4 dispensations that would go against this takana of tikkun olam. First of which is a person for themselves, which includes ishto. Number 2 is muflag b'chokhmah, which is a Talmud Chocham. Then possibility of sakanat nefashot. It's in a time period where the taking of captives is not going to be influenced by the amount of money you paid to ransom the individuals, because they're taking the captives anyway, or it's a free-for-all, and paying them is not going to change the dynamic of the situation. Tosafot gives 4 dispensations over here. Those dispensations basically would allow you to redeem captives above their value almost in all instances, because generally there is sakanat nefashot, there is a risk of their lives being at risk. And then again, if it's, they usually take people who are of stature because they can get more money, so if they take people of stature, muflog b'chokhma would allow them to redeem it, or the person themselves could redeem themselves. So you have a lot of then latitude to redeem above the value of the individual. The Ramban here argues against this Tosafot on a number of levels. He says, first of all, inherently, any captive is sakanat nefashot. So you can't say there's a dispensation for sakanat nefashot, because the Chachamim were aware of that. And when they put the takana in place, they know that captives or hostages have this risk of sakanat nefashot, and therefore that can't be a dispensation. That's the nature of captivity, is that the person is the sakanat nefashot, and despite that fact, the Chachamim say, "Pintei tikkun olam, we won't allow you to pay." The Ramban, in resolving the stirot between the Gemara, says, the Gemara, or the Tana, in Ketubot, argues on our Tana over here. The Tana over there says, you can pay more, you tell me, mehem. And he's against our Mishnah over here. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who argues on that title there, is the author of our Mishnah over here. And possibly Rabbi Shua ben Hananiah, the Ramban says, in Nunchet, is that position in Ketubot. He's the one in Ketubot who believes you pay more than their value, and that might reconcile everything. There's Rabbi Shua ben Hananiah, who's the Tanakam in Ketubot, who says pay whatever you have to pay. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who is in Ketubot, argues on him, is the author of the Mishnah here, and you have a Machloket. And we paskin like the Gemara over here, that there is a limit, and therefore you cannot pay more than that amount. And irrespective of all these dispensations, they don't apply. The only dispensation that the Ramban is willing to entertain is Muflag B'Chochma, is a Talmud Chocham, where possibly there would be the exception. That could explain that Gemara with Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananiah. But otherwise, the Ramban says that inherently built into captive taking is this problem of Sakanat Nefeshot, and that can't be a dispensation for ransoming hostages or captives, because then the whole takana basically falls apart, because that's going to be the situation in every case, basically, and therefore you're always going to redeem them at yoter mikadei demehen. So now, based on this, you have actually a machloket in the Rishonim that actually comes down all the way down to the Shulchan Aruch, which is that the Rif, the Rosh, and those that say that the locha here is because of the garvu, that the locha is the reason we don't do this, because it encourages the taking of more hostages, and therefore they pass in this way against the Gemara in Ketubot, and against maybe Rabbi Shua ben Hananiah later on, versus the Bali at Tosafot and others that paskin, yes, Lugola Garbu applies, but with all these other qualifications around it. And therefore, these other qualifications also are meaningful. But even in these other situations, you still have to worry about Duchaka de Tzibura. So, brought down the Lochad as all of these different trappings. Now, there are a number of famous stories that have influence on the Locha. One of the famous stories is about the Maram Rutenberg. The story is brought down in the Yam Shel Shlomo. He tells the story that the Maram Rutenberg was taken prisoner. He was on his way to making Aliyah l'Eretz Yisrael. And I think it's King Rudolf I imprisoned him and tried to ransom him from the Jewish community at exorbitant sums. The community got the money together and wanted to redeem him. The Maram Rutenberg refused and told the community they may not redeem him because he believed. There's no clear answer as to why he did it. Over there, the Yam Shel Shlomo speculates about this, that the reason that he did not allow them to do this because it would have encouraged the government officials or people to then take other Talmidei Chachamim as hostages and ransom them because it was very lucrative. And what he was afraid of is that if he allowed them to ransom at this price, it would put all the other Talmidei Chachamim or community leaders at risk. And therefore he refuses to allow them to ransom him. And he dies in captivity. He spent 7 years in captivity. His Talmidim, the Hagot Mamoniot, and the Tashbeits visit him there and learn with him. But the Yam Shel Shlomo discusses the fact that because of Bitul Torah and the loss of his communal leadership, he should have allowed them to redeem him. So why didn't he? The Yam Shel Shlomo is perplexed by why the Maram Butuk allowed this to happen. And he says he thinks because it put other people at risk. And he didn't want to put those other people at risk. He dies in captivity. And they keep his body for 14 more years until a very wealthy Jew comes and redeems his body and he's finally brought to burial. But there, the Maram Rutenberg sets a precedent by which even Talmidei Chachamim, communal leaders, should not be ransomed for greater than their value, despite the dispensation here of the Tosafot. Now you could argue that Tosafot is arguing on the Rif and the Rosh, and so you have a Safek Halacha, and when you have a Safek in Sakanat Nefeshot, you go to Kula, and we would paskin like the Bali Tosafot, which would allow it. Other Rishonim say no, that that's not the way the Halacha works. It's not an issue of Safek over here. We paskin like those Rishonim that say there's a problem of encouraging this type of behavior, and therefore it's not allowed at all. Versus some who paskin like the Bali Tosafot, who say yes, it's allowed when he's muflag b'chochma, and the Maram Rutenberg was lifnim ishur at the din. And maybe not even the din. Maybe he shouldn't have done that. Maybe he should have allowed them to redeem him. Other case, which you might remember, it was very common in the 1970s for terrorists to hijack planes. Amongst those was, of course, the Entebbe mission where they were taken to Uganda. Another one of those was this story, a very serious story, brought down in the Ikve Atzon of Rav Shechter on page 206. I saw it brought down in other places as well. Rav Huttner was visiting Eretz Yisrael, and then he was heading back to America at the time. The other part of this story, which I'm not sure about the veracity of this story, is that he visited Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook at the time. And Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook asked him what airline he was flying back, and he refused to fly El Al at the time because he was afraid of the hijackings on the planes. So he took a foreign airline and not El Al. And Rav Zvi Yehuda Cook says that you're wrong. You should be taking the Jewish airline and you should be supporting the Jewish airline. And sure enough, after he leaves there, the plane is hijacked and taken to Jordan. Now, whether that first part of the story took place, I'm not sure, but I did see it brought down. One of the retelling of these stories, that incident took place beforehand. Now, Rav Hutter, amongst many other of the hostages, was held captive in Jordan. And there was a negotiation that went on in order to release the captives. His Talmidim in New York collected huge sums of money in order to redeem Rav Hutner, in order to get him out of captivity, based on this Balei HaTosafot over here, that someone is Muflag B'Chokhma, you redeem them, and I feel your terror can make the mayhem. And they had actually started to negotiate to get the freedom of Rav Hutner. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky in America intervenes, and it asked them to do that. He said, you may not do this, Rav Hutner, because Eretz Yisrael and Jews now in a state of war. And in a state of war, none of this applies because there by definition is sakanat nefashot and you cannot redeem from parties that are your enemy or you're at war with. And therefore, Rabbi Yaakov Kanetsky shuts down this entire process and they in the end do not redeem Rav Hutner Ajitera Kedei Mehem. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky basically sets this precedent that when you're at war or deemed to be at war, then there is no redemption of hostages, period. That doesn't matter. You're Terek HaDemayim, not Kedei HaDemayim. And also, more importantly, even if he's a Muflag B'Chokhma, we do not pay more money for him. Because he said they were at war. And when you're at war, you can't then facilitate the enemy taking hostages and giving them money. First of all, he encourages them. But number two is you're giving money to the enemy and you're funding the war against you. It's counterproductive to do this in a state of war. And besides that, in a state of war, everybody's at risk. To say that they're at risk now because they're held captive, that's no different than everybody is subject to this war, and therefore everybody's at risk. And so therefore he said that they should not do this, and he shut down the process, and they did not redeem Rav Hutner. I saw another story from Rav Shmuel Eliyahu about his father, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. I think it might be about the same event, which is that these people from America wanted to get access to the Bava Sali, that the Bava Sali should daven on behalf of their Rebbe, that he should be freed. And the Bava Sali refused to see the individuals from America. So Shmuel Eliyahu says that his father at the time said that they were asking incorrectly. Their problem was that they were only asking for their Rebbe, and what about the other hostages? How come they were ignoring the other hostages? Which is part of probably what Rabbi Yaakov Kanetsky was also thinking, which is, if they took Rav Hutner out, that would not bode well for the other hostages that were left behind, because they would have gotten their money, and they wouldn't care less about who else was there. They might have killed all the other hostages, meaning that there are some serious considerations here of just plucking one individual out. So over there, he says that Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, first of all, got them to finally acquiesce that he should go make the request for everyone. And then he went to the Bava Sali on behalf of these individuals, and the Bava Sali says, don't worry, they'll be davening with their shul on Rosh Hashanah. They were very upset about this because Rosh Hashanah wasn't close enough. But sure enough, they were released, and supposedly the negotiations went that they were released on Rosh Hashanah. And the plane landed minutes before Rosh Hashanah. They had a car waiting at the airport that took the individual straight to shul. They didn't even have time to shower or nothing, right into shul on Rosh Hashanah. Anyway, he's telling the story about one of these interactions between his father, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, and Bava Sali, that this was the plight of those that the Bava Sali said that they would be released. Because of those two precedents, we see over there this idea of not negotiating, number one, even for someone who's Muflag B'Chokhma, and number two is that when you're deemed at war, that we do not negotiate with the captors or the hostage takers, even though the people's lives are at risk, and even though there's a Muflag B'Chokhma over there. So that actually somewhat sets a stage for what's going on today and the major issues that are faced today by Israel, which is that when soldiers are taken into captivity, what do we do? So number one is that rescue operations, which are important, we'll deal with a little bit more when we get to the next stage of the Mishnah, which talks about whether it's okay or good to do rescue operations. The number two is that you will put other people's lives at risk in order to rescue such an individual. Most posts can believe that that's the nature of war and that's the nature of rescue operations, and therefore it is permitted to put other people's lives at risk to save hostages because there's a value in taking back these hostages, both from the morale of those individuals that are going into war as well as from the perspective of making sure that the captors know that we're not going to leave them there, we're going to come in and take them out. That has led to what we'll see soon in the Gemara, some counterproductive situations, which is now when they take hostages, they take them to places or areas where it would be almost impossible to rescue them because of the density of the areas or the locations they put them in, because they know that in the past they've come in to try to rescue hostages. So that does have some detrimental impact. The second thing is, do you ransom for captives in these situations? So here there are two mindsets, and it leads to a major machloket, both politically and halachically, about whether you should redeem the soldiers for more than their value. It's clear here when we're trading soldiers for a large number of imprisoned terrorists in our jails, that we're paying your terror mikdei demehem. That's no question. Obviously, again, everything's relative, but it's clear that we're paying yoter mikdei demehem. Is that permitted? So if you use the dispensation of Tosafot, Sakanat Nefashot, it's clear that all of our hostages are in a situation or a stake of being Sakanat Nefashot, and therefore trading for them is important according to the Baalei HaTosafot and would be permitted according to the Baalei HaTosafot. According to the Ramban, who says Sakanat Nefashot is by nature what captivity is about, then that dispensation would necessarily apply, and paying your terek demehem would only encourage the behavior more, because they know that that's the only vehicle by which they will get back their friends who are jailed or the terrorists that are jailed. In addition to that, the freeing of terrorists adds an additional aspect of this. You're letting murderers go free in the trade. It's not simply that you're giving them money. You're letting the murderers go free who are going to murder other people, unfortunately. And therefore, there's a risk that you're allowing or unleashing a whole force that will kill more people. Are you allowed to do that? The other question is morale of troops, which is that if you send troops in and they believe you will rescue them, they're more likely to go into battle and fight because they know that we'll never leave you behind. Versus if people know that if they go to war and then they're left there, that they may or never see the day of life, that might discourage soldiers. I've heard from Rav Findel, who is the Rosh Yeshiva, one of the largest, or probably the largest Hesder Yeshiva here in Eretz Yisrael, down in Sderot, that he specifically said that his Talmidim and the soldiers in there say that it's actually the other way around. They think that their morale is ruined by the fact that they trade terrorists for the soldiers, because all the work, all the efforts that they make and put their lives at risk to capture these individuals and to incarcerate them is then going to waste when they are traded. And they would prefer that the Israeli government would not trade for them, and that they think that that is demoralizing, that they're giving up all these terrorists to get the people back, and they themselves would rather that the government left them there and kept these terrorists incarcerated, because it's the benefit of the klal and the benefit to the morale of the soldiers. So he thinks that it's just the opposite, that the morale of the soldiers is actually better if you don't trade them for all these terrorists. Again, much of this is probably personal, and also depending on how close to home the situation is, that might have impact here. But that is the scales by which these issues are being measured, which is this halachic problem of encouraging them to behave this way versus the sakanat nefashot versus what Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky said, which is that we're at war. Even though the battlefield and the nature of war has changed, it's not open battles like the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War, and the Lebanese War, but these are wars with terrorists, which is a different nature of war, but it's a war. And if you're at war, then maybe that also should be an overarching issue here and not allow for the trading of hostages in those situations. So those are all the factors that come in. There's been a lot of literature written about it in the more recent history because, again, just like it was a real topic and a real issue in the time of Chazal, it's a real issue today because of the terrorists taking both soldiers and civilians hostage in order to negotiate with the government of Israel. That's a good question. I won't get into it. I'll just answer you quickly. The Mishnayim here gives where a guy has debts outstanding, and then he's taken into captivity to pay those debts. That's his own fault, in a sense. So he's in debtor's prison. There, the Rishonim still see a value in redeeming him and taking him out because they feel like that's improper incarceration. So I would say the same thing with regards to going to prison. If a person's a criminal and they did something wrong, they belong in prison. And therefore, you don't have to redeem them. The two things that you have to ask. They think that he's improperly convicted, or that the sentence or the punishment was much harsher than the crime that's there, which is, I think, the claim in most of those cases, is that the penalties that were given were far in excess of the violations that were there, and therefore they believe that it's improper incarceration. And you have to find the balance there, which is that if a person belongs in jail, then Gideon Shavuim is not. If in jail they are mistreating him, if they are incarcerating him improperly, the punishments handed out to him are much harsher than anybody else ever found in that situation. Even though he was criminally wrong and he did something wrong, they still see a value in redeeming him and taking him out. Alright. The Chovos Yoyer says that no individual who is held in captivity has an obligation to worry about the other captives. If he can escape and he can leave, the Chovos Yoyer says he should do it. That a person has a right to take care of themselves, to free himself from this situation, and he doesn't have to worry about the other captives when he runs away. Our problem here is when outside forces are trying to encourage or facilitating their running away, what is the impact of that? Now that can have impact in one of two ways, which is the machloket over here. My binayu, what's the nafkamina between these two? Ibnayu delek alechad. Question is, if there's only one that's there. So now, the difference between them is whether we worry about future captives, or we worry about the residual captives that are there. If you say, that the Tana Kama is worried about Tikkun Olam, which is in the future, when it comes to Shvuim, that they will then incarcerate them in much more harsh conditions, difficult conditions, they'll chain them up, they'll do things that won't allow them to run away, but will then make it much harder for future Shvuim because of the fact that this person ran away, then they're going to take different precautions in the future. Whereas for Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, he only worries about the hostages that are currently incarcerated with him. So the Tana Kama looks at Tikkun Olam, looks at all future hostages, and says the Tikkun Olam means that we worry about a more general problem, not just the situation at hand. Shimon Gamliel says we only worry about the situation at hand. If we encourage them to run away and you leave someone behind, they're going to end up either murdering or making the lives of those that remain behind very difficult. And therefore we don't do it because those that you leave behind are going to suffer the consequences of the one who you encourage to escape, which happened in Entebbe. There was a woman who was hospitalized at the time Entebbe left behind, and she was murdered. Again, there, I'm not sure that would be a reason not to do it, but it just, that's what Shimon Gamliel worries about, that you take some hostages and leave some behind, the ones that are left behind will suffer the consequences of those that left. Their Tana Kama looks at it more broadly. Doesn't matter what's this situation, it matters that if we do this in future, it will affect hostage taking if we allow them to escape, which is they're going to have harsher conditions in the future. So the nafkamina here is, if what do you have only one hostage? According to Shimon Gamliel, there's no problem to help him or facilitate their escape, because they're the only one that's there. On the other hand, for the Tana Kama, it's problematic, because in the future, they will then incarcerate Shvuim in a more difficult conditions because of helping him to escape. They used to mix hot pots with their hands. They literally would either pick up the pots or stick their hands into the pot and mix it. So now, Kasha le the Rav Ilish. Rav Ilish could not understand this. How is it that these women are such tzidkaniyot? They are such righteous women, and they were showing how righteous they were by mixing pots with their hands, and showing that they were not affected by the fire. Adam echad me'elef matzati. Pasuk Kehelet says, there's one out of 1,000 men that's a tzaddik, v'isha b'chol elo lo matzati. And a woman I couldn't find at all. Meaning that he can't resolve this pasuk in Kehelet with the fact that Rav Nachman's daughters are these, quote-unquote, great tzidkoniyot, that they're able to mix pots with their hands. Ha'ika b'nate de Rav Nachman. And in his mind he's saying, well, you know what, they're the daughters of Rav Nachman. And how do I reconcile this pasuk with the daughters of Rav Nachman? Garmelahu milta ishtabin. Something happened and they were taken into captivity. Now whether garmelahu milta just means that's what happened, there was something happened and they were taken into captivity, or he would precipitate them being taken into captivity because he was perplexed by their behavior, and therefore it could not be reconciled with the pasuk, they were taken into captivity to deal with this problem. But not only were they taken into captivity, Rav Ilish was taken into captivity with them. So he was in captivity with Rav Nachman's daughters. One day he was sitting in captivity and there was another person, another hostage that was with him, that knew the voices or the language of the birds. Ata Urva, a raven came, the Kakarile, and was calling, was speaking. Amarle, my Kamar. He says to the guy who knows the language of the birds, what's this raven saying? Amar, Ilish Barach, Ilish Barach. Run away, Ilish, run away, Ilish. Amar Urva, Shikrahu. Ravens are liars. And therefore you can't trust the raven. The raven is a bird in general that's seen as a somewhat negative, again in the story of Noach and other places. The Urva in general has a negative connotation with it, and therefore you didn't want to believe the Urva. Los Mechinan Ale, therefore he didn't rely on them. Adahochi Ata Yona. In the interim, a dove shows up, the Kakaria, and then it was also chirping away. Amalei, my camera. What is the dove saying? Amalei, Ilish Baruch, Ilish Baruch. Run away, Rav Ilish, run away, Rav Ilish. So Amar, Knesset Yisrael ko Yona Matila. Knesset Yisrael is compared to Yona. This is also by the famous story of Elisha Bal Knafayim, where he has the tefillin and the Roman is chasing after him. He says, what do you have in your hand? He says, I have a Yona. And he opens up his hands and a Yonah flies out instead of the tefillin turned into a Yonah. And again, the Gemara there says, why a Yonah? Because Bnei Yisrael are compared to a Yonah in Shir HaShirim, Yonati Tamati. So Shmamina mitrachesh li nisa. He says, a miracle is going to happen for me. I got to go. It's my turn to leave. So Amar Ezel achse benate de Rav Nachman, ikayaman behem natayu, ahadrinu. Says, let me go check on the daughters of Rav Nachman and see if they've been faithful. Seems here that they were married, faithful to their husbands, faithful to their religion. And if they are, I'll take them with me, because then if their miracle is going to happen to me, it'll happen for them as well. Amar nishay komili di'itlahu, sadrin lahada di bebeit akise. Says that women, when they talk and gossip, they always do it in the bathroom. So they go to the bathroom in order to gossip, and all the truths come out over there. So especially true in their time, because when they went to the Beit HaKisei, they went out into the fields, into isolated, desolate areas. And when they did that, for protection, they used to speak to each other while they were there to know that the other person was there. So they communicated between them. So he says, I'll go and overhear their conversation and see what they're speaking about. Shemino de Kamron, he heard them saying, Adai Guvrin, these are men. Unardai Guvrin, and those in Nardai are men. Let's tell our captors to take us further away from here, and that our husbands then won't hear about it and come and redeem us. Now, the way that Rashi seems to interpret it is that we have husbands in Narda, and our captors are our husbands. So let's tell the captors to take us far away, because we'll stick out with these husbands and the other ones won't come and redeem us and take us back to Narda. Or basically, they preferred to stay with the captors than to go back to their husbands. That's one way to read it. The other way to read it is that this was their attitude, which is that there are men in Narda, there are men here. Why are the men of Narda any better than the men over here? Or basically, they were becoming attached to their captors. Now, that is a phenomenon, the Stockholm Syndrome, which the Gemara never addresses. But I will tell you something after this, which is interesting. Kam Arak, he ran away. Ato Ihu, Vahu Gavra, he left, and so did the guy who knew the chirping of the birds, knew how the birds spoke, left with him. L'didei Trachish Le'Nisa, for him a miracle was performed. Alpha B'mavra, he made it across. Whether there was a ferry waiting for him, there was a bridge there, he was able to cross the water and escape. Baugavra Ashkechu V'Kadlua, the other guy was caught and killed. By the way, this might be that the Urva, the Orev, was speaking to that guy, and the Yonah was speaking to Rav Elish, and the Urva lied, and that guy was killed, and the Yonah was telling the truth, and that's why Rav Elish survived. Kihadran V'Aton, eventually Rav Nachman's daughters were redeemed and taken out of captivity. Abar Habukabakshan Kidrabikshofim says it's for sure that when they were doing that, they were doing it through sorcery or witchcraft, because they're notes at Kaniyot, these women over here. Because the daughters of Nachman had given in to their captives, and therefore they clearly were not Tzidkaniyot, and that's not why they were able to mix the pots. They were making it look like they were Tzidkaniyot through sorcery or witchcraft. That's what he concludes in the end. Now, what's very interesting here is that Rav Nachman is a Talmud of Shmuel. And Shmuel's daughters are also taken into captivity, and Shmuel's daughters in captivity end up marrying their captors. And one of them marries their captors, and that's why Abba Mari Bar Brat to Shmuel, who is the son of the daughter of Shmuel, Oliver Shas is named for his grandfather, not his father, because his father was one of those captors who later converts to Judaism. But at the time that he was conceived, he was not Jewish. What you see here is a phenomenon, which is, you have the daughters of Shmuel, the daughters of Rav Nachman, both of which live in Narda. Again, Rav Nachman's a Talmud of Shmuel. They're taken into captivity, and in captivity, the daughters end up succumbing to the captors or becoming aligned with the captors or having the Stockholm Syndrome, possibly, which is that they start to identify with their captors and want to stay with the captors and not come back. And in the end, end up marrying their captors or thinking of their captors as their husbands. So, it's interesting from a number of perspectives. First of all, you have two Talmidei Chachamim whose daughters end up in this situation and succumb to the captors. And it's not clear here what type of pressures they were under, what exactly the situation, you can't judge. But it's clear that all of them succumb to the situation. Number two is, we don't know how much of that is because of the Stockholm Syndrome that they started to identify with their captors versus their willingness to give in, or whether they just had Yeush and that's why they gave in. Or, again, what does this mean about the daughters of the Talmidei Chachamim? And this happens over the ages many times, that because of the difference in the treatment of daughters and sons, that the sons many times follow the ways of their parents, and the daughters, because of the lack of education or direct education, going a different path. and not upholding the Torah, and that's what leads to the creation of the Beis Yaakov movement in the beginning because of this problem of this bifurcation of the Mesorah between the girls and the boys. Just a little note here that there is some sort of commonality that this case of Rav Nachman, it's not unique, but even happened to Shmuel's daughters and seems to be a larger phenomenon in the city of Narda, which we've seen a number of captives taken from Narda, which seems to be that it was a common occurrence in that time. The next Mishnah. One may not purchase Sfarim, here means Sifrei Torah, Tfilin and Mizuzot from non-Jews at more than their value, Mipnei Tikkun Olam. Again, because of Tikkun Olam, what the Tikkun Olam over here is, Rashi brings both reasons, Imishum Duchaka de Tzibura, the problem that it will cause a burden on the Tzibur to have to buy this stuff out, Imishum de Lodi Garba Lai Tutfei, or not to encourage this behavior of taking these items because they know that they're going to get huge sums of money when people redeem these items. So now, what it sounds like for the Mishnah is, even though you don't redeem them on your Terek Domain de Mehem, that you actually, for their monetary value, you would redeem them. So from the Mishnah, it sounds like that's an option that you have to redeem them. Although others, including the Rosh, believe that this is an obligation. The Mishnah is telling you the prices you should pay for the obligation to redeem them, not simply the limit on the price if you choose to redeem them. So I'm going to lay Rabudja, the Rabashi. You see from this that you don't purchase them or redeem them for more than their money, but at value, you do redeem them. Shmamina, Sefer Torah shnimtza b'yad ha'kochavim, karimbo. So from this you should conclude that if you have a Sefer Torah that's found in a non-Jew's hands and he sells it, that you're allowed to use it. And you can read from it and use it b'tzibur. It's a kosher Sefer Torah. Because we assume that he didn't write it, that a Jew wrote it, and it just ended up in his possession. It says, no, Dilma lignos. How do you know that you have to redeem it because it's functional and you can use it? Maybe you have to redeem it in order to put it into Geniz. And that's what I just discussed. The possibility here that the obligation to redeem it is not to use it, but rather just to put it into Geniz and ensure that it doesn't end up in the improper hands. Amar Rav Nachman. Nafkinan. We have a conclusion halachically. Sefer Torah shikatavo min yistaref. A Sefer Torah that's written by a min is burnt, meaning that it's clearly lacking kedusha. It was written for Avodah Zarah, and therefore it is burnt. Now, the min over here, Rashi defines min all over Shas as someone who's aduk b'ovedat kochavim. Someone who is strongly attached to Avodah Zarah, and he gives an example, a komer. Someone who is a priest to the Avodah Zarah, that's someone who's considered to be a min. Other Rishonim argue on Rashi and say a min is a Jew apostate that left the religion and became a duk to Avodah Zarah and becomes very attached to Avodah Zarah. Either way, the problem here is that he's definitely writing at the shame of Avodah Zarah, and therefore the Sefer Torah is pasul and is burnt. Kitavo uvdei kochavim. If it's written by a non-Jew, just a regular non-Jew, iganez, then it's put into geniza because we're not sure. I'm not sure if the Ovid Kochavim wrote it, the Stam, or did the Ovid Kochavim write it, the Shame of Avodah Zarah. Since we don't know what his intent was at the time, we put it into Gniza because of that uncertainty. Nimsa b'yad min, if a min is selling a Sefer Torah, yiganez, then you put it into Gniza because we don't know if he wrote it or if he purchased it for someone else. If he wrote it, it's l'sreifa. If he didn't write it, then it's possibly kosher, but you have too much risk here. So we say put it in Geniza. Nimsa biyad Ovi Kochavim. If an Ovi Kochavim has the same Torah that he's selling, then Amrila Yiganez. Some say that he put it into Geniza, but Amrila Korinbo. You're allowed to use it. I mean, that's a functional Sefer Torah. Rashi says that the two sides are. If it's in the hand of Yoh Kochavim, if some say you put it into Geniza, because maybe this Ovi Kochavim himself wrote it. And since he wrote it, we're going to be worried about it then, because the Sefer Torah of an Ovi Kochavim goes into Geniza. Or maybe he didn't write it. Others say that you read it. Why do you read it? Rashi says, Sfeik Sfeika. It's a double Sfeik. First of all, maybe Yisrael wrote it. Maybe an Ovi Kochavim wrote it. We don't know. Even if an Ovi Kochavim wrote it, maybe he wrote it to Shem Shemayim or Stam. Or maybe he wrote it to Avodah Zarah. You have here a Sfeik Sfeika. So Sfeik Sfeika should allow you, Korinbo, to be able to read the Sefer Torah. Whereas the Tosfot disagrees with Rashi and says, he quotes Rashi and says, Vein Nira. So if Nachan Kamar Katavov de Kochavim Iganez, Behainu Afilu Katavov Im Kor Yisrael, that if a non-Jew writes the Sefer Torah, even if he writes it to sell it to Israel, so he knows not to make it for Avodah Zarah, Still, we do not allow it to be used, and we put it into Geniza. The reason is because there is a din, that anybody who has a din in Kshirat Tfilin has a din in Ktivat Tfilin. That you have to be chayav in the mitzvah in order to be allowed to write the mitzvah, or to write the tefillin, to write the mezuzot, or to write the Sefer Torah. Time of Darmi La Korimbo, Mishum De'ika Lemitle Tfei, Shisrael Kadavo, Dein Derech Ovdei Kochavim Lichtov. The reason that you can read from such a Sefer Torah is, what is this Ovdei Kochavim doing with the Sefer Torah? You say you wrote it? What are the chances that Ovdei Kochavim wrote a Sefer Torah that looks ke'alacha, that seems far-fetched and crazy? So if we don't know that he wrote it, and he's trafficking, he's selling Sifrei Torah, you can assume that this Sefer Torah came from Yisrael, landed in his hands, is most likely a kosher Sefer Torah. And that's why they allow you to read it. And of course, it's all true when there is questions about the yichus of this Sefer Torah. But if it's known that this Sefer Torah came from the Jewish community and was a Sefer Torah of Jews, then when you redeem it, you can even read from it because it's clearly a Jewish Sefer Torah that was taken from the Jewish community and was a kosher Sefer Torah beforehand. Now that problem that you're mentioning came up in the late 1800s, where many maskilim were raiding Sefer Torah. It was especially problematic in Vilna, because it was well known that there were sofrim there that were not Shomrei Shabbat, that were writing Sefer Torah, because that was their profession. That was the only thing they were equipped to do, and so they had to make a living. They made a living by writing Sefer Torah, even though they were no longer religious or Shomrei Shabbat. Some of those Sefer Torah that are still around, those Sefer Torah that were written by Maskilim, they're known. Larger sizes of plaf, and they're written in a certain way where it also has to do with the end of the Sefer Torah, how the end of the Sefer Torah is written. Generally, when you have a Sefer Torah that's written kalacha, the last couple letters are messy because they allow the people to fill them in. On the other hand, these Maskilim wrote it so straight to the end so that it was a complete Sefer Torah. It doesn't have that at the end. There's certain identifying marks about these Sefer Torah that Sofrim, their experts, know about it. And they know to look for them to know that these are Sifrei Torah that have questions about them and are questionable in terms of their source or their Masorah and their formation, maybe not should not be used. That's the same issue here. If these Sifrei Torah are in circulation, we assume generally that they're written by Shomrei Shabbat individuals who are men, because those are the only people who write Sifrei Torah. Now, in the modern day, where some of the other movements start allowing women to write Sifrei Torah, and now they do come into circulation, that assumption might be more problematic. The assumption also was tested in the time when the Maskilim, where there are people who were trained as Sofrim and good Sofrim, but were not Shomrei Shabbat, that those Torahs went into circulation and they were well known. The Torahs that came from the city of Vilna were problematic because most of the Sofrim in that city were Maskilim and not Shomrei Shabbat. So now, Sefer Torah, Shekitavo Oved Kochavim. Sefer Torah is written by Oved Kochavim. Tani Chada Yisareif. One writer says it should be burnt. V'tani Idach Higanez. It should be written to Geniza. V'tani Idach Korimbo. And there's a third writer that says you can use it. Lokash. Had the Tani Yisareif. The one that says that you burn it. Rabbi Eliezer. Tamar. Stam Machshevet Oved Kochavim. Lovedat Kochavim. The Belozer who believes that the Stam, the default Machshava of an Oved Kochavim is for Avodat Kochavim. Here it's talking about the case of Shechita. If an Oved Kochavim shechs, we assume he shechted Avodah Zarah. That's Rabbi Elazar's belief, that when he shechs, he has in mind Avodah Zarah. V'ad Tanya Yiganez, Ha'itanohu. The one who says that it goes into Geniza is this Tana. The Tani Rav Hamnuna Breid Rava, Ipashonaya, Sefer Torah, Tfilinu Mezuzot, Shiktavan. Now we leave out the word min over here, probably, because the word min we saw before, a min's product is burnt. And over here we're talking about Geniza. So it's likely that he's not in here. Masur, this is someone who gives over individuals to the authorities. Oved Kochavim, a non-Jew, Ve'eved, Isha, V'katan. All these individuals are disqualified from writing a Sefer Torah. V'kuti, Yisrael Mumar, Ikuti, or Yisrael who does not keep the halachos, Psulin. There's Sefer Torah, Pasol, Shenemar, Ukshartam, Ktaptam, Kol Sheyeshno B'Kshira, Yeshno B'Ktiva. If you're Chayav in Kshira, then you can write. If you're not chayav in putting on tefillin, then you're not permitted to write a Sefer Torah. So Rashi says here, the deficit by the kuti is that they are gerer rayot, that they were not true converts, and therefore they're deemed to be like non-Jews. Masur is someone who's malshin, that hands over other Jews to the authorities. And a mumar is someone who just doesn't keep the halachot, that he outwardly and publicly does not keep certain basic halachot. And the deficit by the Mumar and the Masur is that they were porekol, and therefore they're no longer people who can be trusted, or that are going to do things l'shem shamayim because of the fact that their behavior indicates that they are individuals who don't care about their religious practice, whether they are psulim midrabanan or midoraita might depend on what they are mumarim for, including whether they are mumarim l'kshira, of putting on tefillin. But everybody agrees that they are psulim. It's a question of that's psul derabanan or is that a psul deoraita. So that excludes a nobi kochavim, an eved, an isha, a katan, a kuti, all these individuals are excluded. Very good. So Tosfot asked your question. Says that a woman should not be able to make tzitzit or to bind a lulav. Came into law mifkida. Because she's not chayevet. She's not commanded to do these mitzvot. Therefore, she should not be able to make them or prepare them. Ve'ein nirin. Tosfot says, I don't think Rabbeinu Tam is right. Damin paslinan tzitzit ba'ovei kochavim. In Menachot, it says that an ovei kochavim cannot make tzitzit. But they say, Bnei Yisrael, v'lo ovdei kochamim, michlal di ishak shera, that a woman is muteret. Ramnina naviv sukat ganbach shera. And they also over there say that a sukkah of a woman is also shera. So you see in mitzvot, even though they're not obligated in the mitzvah, I mean they can opt in, but they're not obligated, that in those cases the woman can perform and prepare the mitzvah, and it's considered to be a mitzvah shera. B'davka b'sefer Torah, Tzfilin u'mezuzot. All those items, dichtiv u'kshartam u'khtavtam, darshin and hochi. It's a unique principle to these three, tam, sefer Torah, tzfilin and mezuzot, where they have this hekesh, where mezuzah, limud Torah, and tzfilin are all found in the same parsha. And there you have the hekesh between u'kshartam u'khtavtam, which tells you, if you're not chayav in the mitzvah, you can't prepare the mitzvah, you can't write the mitzvah. So a woman is chayavet in mezuzah, but it's part of the hekesh. Because it says uchtatam right after ukshartam, and therefore there's a hekesh between mezuzah and tefillin, and therefore Tosfot believes it applies to all of these items. And despite the fact that Tosfot rejects Rabbeinu Tam, we are choshesh for the Rabbeinu Tam, and therefore we don't allow women to make tzitzit or to tie the knots of the tzitzit because of this problem that the Rabbeinu Tam raises over here. So that he'll be the author of this position, that kol sheyeshlo mikshira yeshlo miktiva, and that's why it goes into Geniza. Ha the Tanya Korimbo, and the Brita that says that you can use the Sefer Torah, Hai Tanahu, it's this Tana, the Tanya, Lochim Sfarim in Ovde Kochavim B'chol Makom, Bavad Shiyuk Tuvim Keolchatan, that you can buy them from the Ovde Kochavim as long as they are written Keolcha. Umayse B'Ovde Kochavim Echad B'Tzidan, there was this non-Jew in Tzidan, Sheya Kutev Sfarim, Ve'itir Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Likach Mimenu, Shimon Gamliel says it's mutar to buy from him. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Ibud Lishman Boi, Ktiva Lishman Do Boi. Is it possible that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel requires you to tan the skins for their particular usage? It means that you have to tan on Lishma, Lishem Torah, Lishem Tefillin, Lishem Mezuzah. But then he doesn't require you to have it written Lishma. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is going to say that the Oroth have to be made Lishma. But then Ovi Kochavim can go ahead and write a Sefer Torah. You don't worry about Lishma. How is that possible? It doesn't seem like that's right. Tosfot over here asks, so why is the Gemara so perplexed by the fact that Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel requires Ibud Lishma and not Ktiva Lishma? He says that the default status of these two items might be different. It might be that someone who's writing a Sefer Torah, Alastam, he's doing it Lishma. Because why else would you write a Sefer Torah unless you were writing it to be a Sefer Torah? On the other hand, when it comes to tanning the hides over there, it's not clear. People tan hides for cloth to be used in religious objects, but they also tan hides to be used in other objects. And therefore, over there, the default is not that it's lishma, and that's why you would require that you do a lishma over there. So Tosfot says you could come up with a distinction that would not make this so perplexing, which is the lishma is required by ibud because that's not the default status, whereas by ktiva you don't require lishma because the default is that it's done lishma. Tosfot leaves that as a tzarachion as to why the Gemara is so perplexed by this position of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. The Tanya tzipan zav osha talalehem or behemat meya. If he decorates them with gold, or he uses a non-kosher animal to make the tefillin, psulot. That's based on the drasha of the chachamim that tefillin can only be made min amutar beficha, something that could be eaten by you from a kosher animal. Those are the only items that may be used in the making of tefillin. Or beimak torak sheirot. If he uses the skins of a kosher animal, then it's kosher, even if it is not necessarily that the animal was kosher. It could be a nevela, a trefa. That's not a problem. They don't have to be tanned for their particular usage. Even if it comes from a kosher animal, they're pasul unless you tan them, you work them, particularly for the mitzvah that they're going to be used for. So that's the Gemara's question. How could it be that he requires that the Ibud be done the Shema, and the Ketivah not have to be done the Shema? Now, first of all, Tosafot says over here, from Shimon Gamliel Kaimalon, we paskin like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel to buy Ibud the Shema, that you have to do Ibud the Shema, and that's what we do today. All tanning is done the Shema. But you should know that there are two different ways to do the Shema, and many people are makpid on this, and you have to ask your sofer when you buy something from him, which is that many times what they do is they do what's called Ibud al Tanai. They make an Ibud al Tanai, which is that they tan it, saying that if I want to, I'll use it for a Sefer Torah. If I want, I'll use it for tefillin, I'll use it for mezuzah. The reason to do that is because when you're using it for a Sefer Torah and you make a mistake on the Yeriyah and you have to throw it out, many times there's enough left there that you can cut it off and then use it for a tefillin or a mezuzah. So if you're me'abed it specifically for that item, then when that item is no longer usable, then you can't use it for something else. So there's a value, meaning that there's a savings by doing this Ibud al Tanai, which is that if something goes wrong, then I can transfer it over to be used for another item or another article. So many people use that, and it's probably the most common way to do Ibud. On the other hand, there are many that are makpid that doesn't work. You have to do Ibud specifically either for Sefer Torah, tefillin and mezuzot, and Ibud doing this al Tanai doesn't work. And therefore, there are those, especially the briskers, that are makbid, to make sure that when they buy these items, that they specifically ask the sofer only to get them klaf that has mu'ubad for this specific item. Again, it will make it a drop more expensive, because when the ibud al-tanai allows you to then sell the klaf for the sefer Torah a little cheaper, because it might be able to use, if it's lost, you can use it for tefillin and mezuzah. So it makes a cheaper way to get the klaf for the tefillin and mezuzah. It also reduces the price, but it's probably a worthwhile item to be machmir for, that the Ibud be done specifically for the item that is being used here in the Stam. So how did Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel over there allow them to be buying Stam from a Goy? But he doesn't require Ketiva Lishma. So Amar Rabbi Shimon Begir Shechazar L'Suro. It was a case of a convert who went back to his old ways. L'Suro? If he went back to his old ways, Kol Shekein Davilei Min. Then he's definitely a min, and he would make it not only can you not buy from him, you have to be burn it. Because if he was converted to Judaism, then goes back to Avodah Zarah, he's definitely a duk by Avodah Zarah, and that would be problematic. So Ravashi, Chazar Nusuro Mishum Ira, that he went back to his old ways because of fear. What ended up happening here is that he converted to Judaism, and he wanted to remain a Jew. But either the city was being taken over by non-Jews, or his former congregants were looking for him, and they were going to kill him because he converted to Judaism. So his life was at risk. So what he did was he went undercover. And he remained a Jew undercover, but on the outside he looked like a goy, he acted like a goy because his life was at risk. It was sakanat nifashot for him. So over there he was a Jew. He did have the right intentions, and that's why Rabbi Shimon Gamliel allowed it, because he did it ketiva lishma. He assumed that he did it properly, and he was doing it properly. But now that he was a full-fledged goy, that wouldn't be allowed. And of course, if he was a ger that went back to his old ways, he wouldn't be allowed, because then he'd be a min. But it was a case where he converted, and his intentions were the shamayim and the shem shamayim. It's just that he had to cover it up, because his life was at risk. Tana banan. Malin bidmeim ad kedei tarpik. One is allowed to go over their price by a tarpik. My tarpik, amrav sheshet istira. It is an istira, which is a coin, a sela medina. A sela medina is 1/8 of a sela tzuri, or, in other words, a half a dinar. Because there are 4 dinar in a sela, and it is worth 1/8 of a sela tzuri. So if you do that, it becomes half a dinar. So that's how much you're allowed to add on. Question is, what does that mean, half a dinar? Could mean a very small amount, which just means a tiny amount you're allowed to add on. I mean, if it's a slightly above the real price, then it's fine. That's one way to learn it. Some say that it has to do with that the normal price of these items is a sela, and therefore half a dinar tells you can go up to 1/8 over the price. And that is the percentage differential that you're allowed, which is 1/8. And that addresses the problem of Tosafot. Tosafot over here says, how can you use the same excess amount for Sfarim, Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzot? The cost of the Torah is multiples of what Tefillin and Mezuzot cost. So how could you say that it's a tarpik for Sfarim, Tefillin, and Mezuzot? I could use the same amount for all of them. If it's a ratio, then it makes a lot more sense, which is 1/8 of their underlying price. And that's what the Gemara is identifying over here. And that's what Tosafot says, Ksatema, Deich Meshaveh Ashat Sfarim Shedemeim Yikarim Lalot Kedei Tarpik Kamo Tefillin Mezuzot. V'kach Nira Dekoye Tefillin Mezuzot. Tosafot says that he thinks the Gemara is the only time at a Tefillin Mezuzot, And that you would use some sort of ratio to get that over to Sifrei Torah, so that it is an equal amount above that level. But to say that they all have the same amount, that you can go just this half a dinar above, half a dinar relative to the price of tefillin and mitzvot is much greater than a half dinar versus that of a Sefer Torah. Therefore, Tosafot says you really need to look at this on a percentage terms and not on a fixed value terms. Whereas the Rid says over here, Vishayin liknot tefillin min amotzam kol zug b'chatzi dinar. The Rid sees this not as being the excess amount, but being the price that one is allowed to pay for tefillin, which is a chatzi dinar. V'enzei lui anikar shitnu libam lishlomehen. Because that's not an excessive amount. It's a small amount of money, maybe even though it's above their true value, but it's small enough that it will not encourage this behavior in the future. So the Tosafot Rid sees here this being the limit to what you can spend, rather than the excess amount that you can spend above its true value. There was this woman merchant, Ishmaelite, that brought tefillin, a pair of tefillin to Abaye. Amrala, Yahavet li, Reish, Reish, Bitamre. Says, give me pairs. It seems like she might have had more than one pair. Give me each pair for a date. Buying them on the cheap. Imalio Ziara, she became enraged by the small price that he was offering here. Shakloi, she took them, Shadindu Benara, and threw them into the river. Amar loi baili li zozolinhi ba'apa kulihai. I shouldn't have been so cheap about these tefillin because in the end it made her feel like they were worthless and therefore she threw them out. So you have to give a price that gives them some sort of value, but not a price that's so little that the guy says it's not even worth selling, that he's going to throw them in the garbage or throw them into the river. So there is a balance here in negotiating that you don't overpay, but on the other hand, you're not mizalzel so much that they don't care to sell them anymore. It's not worth it to them to sell them. Rather throw them in the garbage than sell them to you. So what Abaye is saying is you need to balance between those two, between being too cheap and paying too much money for the item. It has to give it enough value that's worth it to them to sell it to you, but not so much value that it becomes an encouragement for them to continue and steal in the future. Okay, next Mishnah. Motziat ishto mishum shemra. Person divorces his wife because of rumors that are circulating about her behavior. Lo yakzir. He may not remarry her. Mishum nader. If he divorces her because of nedarim that she took, lo yakzir. He may not remarry her. So the whole institution here seems to be that we don't want Bnot Yisrael putzot b'arayot and putzot b'nedarim. We don't want them engaging in this type of promiscuous or taking that dream in a lighthearted manner. So therefore there's a penalty here that if a husband divorces because of these issues that they can't remarry. So that the woman will think twice before she gets involved in these situations or gets into a predicament that might result in divorce because that will be permanent. And even if she clears up the situation, she won't be able to get remarried. Or the other possibility of why we do this is because of kilkula, which is that if we allow the husband to take her back, and later on he realizes that the rumors weren't true, or he realizes that the nether could have had hafara or hatara, then what he's going to do is say, I regret divorcing this woman. And that regret's going to lead to the fact that she really wasn't divorced. And then when she married the next man, she wasn't rightfully married to him, and then she'll have mamzerim. So in order to prevent that problem, we say, no, when you divorce her for this reason, you're not going to get remarried to her. So for one of those two reasons, the Tanakhama says that we don't allow him to remarry. Any nether that the public knows about, then he can't return her. If the public does not know about it, then it should not be mafzir. What the issue of the public is, Rashi over here says that lo yakzir is because ain lo hafara. There's no way to be mafir such a nether because it's a nether al dat rabim, basically what Rashi is saying. Rashi says, Rabbi Yehuda rejects the reason of chayish v'kukula. He doesn't worry about the fact that the husband might regret it later. Elo shloi benot yisrael putzot bin nedarim. He doesn't want them to be perutz nedarim. Hilkach. Inadra neder b'rabim, which is a real pritzot. There we are penalizing her and say he can't get remarried. But if it's done privately, then we don't have that penalty. Or, you can read in Rabbi Yehuda that it was a neder al dat rabim. It's a neder that cannot be revoked. There is no hatarat to such a neder. And therefore, we don't have to worry about kilkula, because he can never back out of it. And therefore, if he divorces her, we say it is a permanent divorce in order to prevent women from taking such nidarim. Rabbi Meir Omer, kol neder shetzarich chakirat chacham lo yakzir. Any neder that requires a petach, a chacham, a hatarav the chacham, then you can't take her back, because that's where you worry about kilkula. Kilkula is the case where he regrets and later finds out that the chacham could have been matter the neder. And therefore, he says, oh, I regret divorcing her. Rashi over here says that a nether that requires chafirat chacham is because hafara doesn't work here. It's not a nether of beino de beina or of inui nefesh where the husband himself can do the hafara. He has to go to a chacham because he needs a petach in the nether over here. It would not suffice the hafara. On the other hand, so that's a case where you can't. She'enu tzarich chakirat chacham yachzir. On the other hand, if it doesn't require a petach, whether that means it's impossible to be matirit, or it's so obvious that you don't even need the chacham, the petach is mitzido, and it's null and void anyway, there you can be machzir, because then he can't say, had I known, because there's nothing to know. The nether was null and void automatically. So I'm Rabbi Lazar, lo asru zeh, ele mipnei zeh. So Rabbi Lazar says, no, they only asked this because of this. Which means that the reason that they were oser the chakirat chacham is because of the case that there is no chakirat chacham. Because we don't worry about the case of kilkol, we worry about prutzot, ve'arayot and prutzot bin nidarim. And if we don't shut this down and say that you can't get remarried, the women are going to continue to take nidarim. So they want to shut it down and say, you can't remarry. And that's even without the chakirat chacham. And the chakirat chacham doesn't bother him. And the reason is, a very interesting reason, Rashi says, the anan sadeh, that we know empirically, that ein adam motzei shetitbazeh ishto, person doesn't want his wife to have to go in a public forum in court to get hatarat nidarim. He'd rather divorce her and not stay married to her and not have her be matir the nether in public in front of the chacham. Because of that reasoning, he says that we're never going to worry about kilkol because it's never going to be that retroactively he's going to say, I regret. I wish we did hatarat nidarim and I wish I stayed married her. Because he won't say that. We know that people would rather get divorced than have his wife in the public forum in the court system getting hatarat nidarim. So therefore, what you have here is a tension in what the reason is for the takana over here. Is the reason to prevent the women from engaging in this behavior, prutzot? Is it because of kilkol, the regret after the fact that it is? Or is it both? Or is it neither of those? And that will lead to your different views here as to whether, when you can and cannot, return the woman in these instances. Amar Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, Maseh b'tzidan b'echad shamar l'ishto, kuna mimeni migarshcha. He says, I take a nether, I'm maser b'hana, if I don't divorce you. B'girsha. And then he divorced her. V'itirulo chachamim shiachzirena mipnei tikkun olam. The chachamim allowed him to take her back because of tikkun olam. Again, that have to be explained in the Gemara because seemingly this goes against the tikkun olam that we have been saying all along, which is the tikkun olam says that he can't remarry her. But over here, the tikkun olam was that he could take her back, so we'll have to explain that in the Gemara. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Gemara on the bottom of Memhei Amudet.